to start off the weekend with that text. So I'll hand you over to Edwin.
Good evening, everybody. How we live and how we might live, by William Morris, is probably one of the most representative summings up of most of the main ideas that the party stands for. And I'd like to read it for you now. Those of you who are familiar with the text will probably know that some of the language is rather old-fashioned. And so this is a slightly shortened and modified version to take show consideration to the ears of a modern audience. The word revolution, which we socialists are so often forced to use, has a terrible sound in most people's ears, even when we have explained to them that it does not necessarily mean a change accompanied by riot and all kinds of violence, and cannot mean a change made mechanically and in the teeth of opinion by a group of men who have somehow managed to seize on the executive power for the moment. Even when we explain that we use the word revolution in its etymological sense, and mean by it a change in the basis of society, people are scared at the idea of such a vast change, and beg that you will speak of reform and not revolution. As, however, we socialists do not at all mean by our word revolution what these worthy people mean by their word reform, I can't help thinking it would be a mistake to use it, whatever projects we might conceal beneath its harmless emblem. So we will stick to our word, which means a change of the basis of society. It may frighten people, but it will at least warn them that there is something to be frightened about, which will be no less dangerous for being ignored. And also it may encourage some people, and will mean to them at least not a fear, but a hope. Fear and hope, those are the names of the two great passions which rule the race of man, and with which revolutionists have to deal. To give hope to the many oppressed, and fear to the few oppressors, that is our business. If we do the first and give hope to the many, the few must be frightened by their hope. Otherwise we do not want to frighten. It is not revenge we want for poor people, but happiness. Indeed, what revenge can be taken for the thousands of years of the sufferings of the poor? However, many of the oppressors of the poor, most of them, we will say, are not conscious of their being oppressors. We shall see why presently. They live in an orderly, quiet way themselves, as far as possible removed from the feelings of a Roman slaver. They know that the poor exist, but their sufferings do not present themselves to them in a trenchant and dramatic way. They themselves have troubles to bear, and they think doubtless that to bear trouble is the lot of humanity. Nor have they any means of comparing the troubles of their lives with those of people lower in the social scale. And if ever the thought of those heavier troubles obtrudes itself upon them, they console themselves with the maxim that people do get used to the troubles they have to bear, whatever they may be. Our present system of society is based on a state of perpetual war. Do any of you think that this is as it should be? I know that you have often been told that the competition, which is at present the rule of all production, is a good thing and stimulates the progress of the race. But the people that tell you this should call competition by a shorter name of war, if they wish to be honest, and you would then be free to consider whether or no war stimulates progress, otherwise than as a mad bull chasing you over your own garden, maybe. War or competition, whichever you please to call it, means at the best pursuing your own advantage at the cost of someone else's loss. And in the process of it, you will certainly come by worse in the struggle. You understand that perfectly as the kind of war in which people go out to kill and be killed. That sort of war in which ships are commissioned, for instance, to sink, burn and destroy. But it appears that you are not so conscious of this waste of goods when you're only carrying on that other war called commerce. Observe, however, that the waste is there all the same. Now let us look at this kind of war a little closer, run through some of the forms of it, that we may see how the burn, sink, and destroy is carried on. First, you have that form of it called national rivalry, which in good truth is nowadays the cause of all gunpowder and bayonet wars which civilized nations wage. For years past, we English have been rather shy of them, except on those happy occasions when we could carry them on at no sort of risk to ourselves, when the killing was all on one side, or at all events we hoped it would be. We have been shy of gunpowder powder war with a respectable enemy for a long time now, and I will tell you why. It is because we have had the lion's share of the world market. We didn't want to fight for it as a nation, for we had got it. But now this is changing in a most significant, and to a socialist, the most cheering way. We are losing or have lost that lion's share. It is now a desperate competition between the great nations of civilization for the world market, and tomorrow it may be a desperate war for that end. As a result, the furthering of war is no longer confined to the honor and glory kind of old Tories, who, if they meant anything at all by it, meant that a Tory war would be a good occasion for damping down democracy. We have changed all that, and now it is quite another kind of politician who is wont to urge us on to patriotism, as it is called. The leaders of the progressive liberals, as they would call themselves, long-headed persons who know well enough that social movements are going on, who are not blind to the fact that the world will move with their help or without it. These have been the jingoes of these later days. I don't mean to say that they know what they are doing. Politicians, as you well know, take good care to shut their eyes to everything that may happen 6 months ahead. But what is being done is this, that the present system, which always must include national rivalry, is pushing us into a desperate scramble for the markets on more or less equal terms with other nations, because, once more, we have lost that command of them which we once had. Desperate is not too strong a word. We shall let this impulse to snatch markets carry us whither we will, whither it must. Today it is successful burglary and disgrace. Tomorrow it may be mere defeat and disgrace. Now, this is not a digression, though in saying this I am nearer to what is generally called politics than I shall be again. I only want to show you what commercial war comes to when it has to do with foreign nations, and that even the dullest can see how mere waste must go with it. That is how we live now with foreign nations, prepared to ruin them without war if possible, with it if necessary, let alone meantime the disgraceful exploiting of savage tribes and barbarous people on whom we force our shoddy wares and our hypocrisy at the cannon's mouth. Well, surely socialism can offer you something in place of that. It can. It can offer you peace and friendship instead of that. We might live utterly without national rivalries, acknowledging that while it is best for those who feel that they naturally form a community under one name to govern themselves, yet that no community in civilization should feel that it had interests opposed to any other, their economical conditions being at any rate similar. So that any citizen of one community could fall to work and live without disturbance of his life when he was in a foreign country and would fit into his place quite naturally. So that all civilized nations would form one great community, agreeing together as to the kind and amount of production and distribution needed, working at such and such production where it could be best produced, avoiding waste by all means. Please to think of the amount of waste which they would avoid, how much such a revolution would add to the wealth of the world. What creature on earth could be harmed by such a revolution? Would not everybody be the better for it? And what hinders it? I will tell you presently. Meantime, let us pass from this competition between nations to that between the organisers of labour, great firms, joint stock companies, capitalists in short, and see how competition stimulates production among them. Indeed, it does do that, but what kind of production? Well, production of something to sell at a profit, or say production of profits. And note how war commercial stimulates that. A certain market is demanding goods. There are, say, 100 manufacturers who make that kind of goods, and every one of them would, if he could, keep that market to himself, and struggles desperately to get as much of it as he can, with the obvious result that presently the thing is overdone, and the market is glutted, and all that fury of manufacture has to sink into cold ashes. Doesn't that seem something like war to you? Can't you see the waste of it? Waste of labour, skill, cunning, waste of life, in short? Well, you may say, but it cheapens the goods. In a sense, it does, and yet only apparently, as wages have a tendency to sink for the ordinary worker in proportion as prices sink. And at what a cost do we gain this appearance of cheapness? Plainly speaking, at the cost of cheating the consumer and starving the real producer for the benefit of the gambler, who uses both consumer and producer as his milk cow. I needn't go at length into the subject of adulteration, for everyone knows what kind of part it plays in this sort of commerce. but remember that it is an absolutely necessary incident to the production of profit out of Wales, which is the business of the so-called manufacturer. And this you must understand, that taking him in the lump, the consumer is perfectly helpless against the gambler. The goods are forced on him by their cheapness, and then with a certain kind of life which that energetic, that aggressive cheapness determines for him. For so far-reaching is this curse of commercial war that no country is safe from its ravages. The traditions of 1,000 years fall before it in a month. It overruns a weak or semi-barbarous country, and whatever romance or pleasure or art existed there is trodden down into a mire of sordidness and ugliness. The Indian or Javanese craftsman may no longer ply his craft leisure, working a few hours a day, in producing a maze of strange beauty on a piece of cloth. A steam engine is set a-going at Manchester, and that victory over nature and 1,000 stubborn difficulties is used for the base work of producing a sort of plaster of china clay and shoddy. And the Asiatic worker, if he is not starved to death outright, as plentifully happens, is driven himself into a factory to lower the wages of his Manchester brother worker, and nothing of character is left him except, most like an accumulation of fear and hatred, to that to him most unaccountable evil, his English master. The South Sea Islander must leave his canoe carving, his sweet rest, and his graceful dances, and become the slave of a slave. Trousers, shoddy, rum, missionary, and fatal disease, he must swallow this civilization in the lump, and neither himself nor we can help him now till social order displaces the hideous tyranny of gambling that is ruined. Let those be types of the consumer. But now for the producer. I mean the real producer, the worker. How does this scramble for the plunder of the market affect him? The manufacturer, in the eagerness of his war, has had to collect into one neighbourhood a vast army of workers. He has drilled them till they are as fit as may be for his special branch of production, that is, for making a profit out of it. And with the result of their being fit for nothing else. Well, when the glut comes in that market he is supplying, what happens to this army? Every private in which has been depending on the steady demand in that market, and acting as he could not choose but act, as if it were to go on forever. You know well what happens to these men. The factory door is shut on them, on a very large part of them often, and at the best on the reserve army of labour, so busily employed in the time of inflation. What becomes of them? We know that well enough just now, but what we don't know, or don't choose to know, is that this reserve army of labour is an absolute necessity for commercial war. If our manufacturers had got these poor devils whom they could draft onto their machines when the demand swelled, other manufacturers in France or Germany or America would step in and take the market from them. Just let your minds run for a moment on the kind of waste which this means. This opening up of new markets among savage and barbarous countries, which is the extreme type of force of the profit market on the world. And you will surely see what a hideous nightmare that profit is. It keeps us sweating and terrified for our livelihood, unable to read a book or look at a picture or have pleasant fields to walk in or to lie in the sun or to share in the knowledge of our time, to have in short either animal or intellectual pleasure. And for what? That we may go on living the same slavish life till we die, in order to provide for a rich man what is called a life of ease and luxury. That is to say, a life so empty, unwholesome and degraded that perhaps on the whole, that he is worse off than we, the workers, are. And as to the result of all this suffering, it is luckiest when it is nothing at all, when you can say that the wares have done nobody any good. For oftenest they have done many people harm, and we have toiled and groaned and died in making poison and destruction for our fellow. That takes us to the third form of war commercial. The last, and the one that the rest is founded on. We have spoken first of the war of rival nations. Next, we speak of that of rival firms. We have now to speak of rival men. As nations under the present system are driven to compete with one another for markets of the world, and as firms or the captains of industry have to scramble for their share of the profits of the markets, so also have the workers to compete with each other for livelihood. and it is this constant competition or war amongst them which enables the profit grinders to make their profits, and by means of the wealth so acquired to take all the executive power of the country into their hands. But here is the difference between the position of the workers and the profit makers. To the latter, the profit grinders, war is necessary. You cannot have profit making without competition, individual, corporate, and national. But you may work for a livelihood without competing. You may combine instead of competing. I have said that war was the life breath of the profit makers. In like manner, combination is the life of the workers. The working class or proletariat cannot even exist as a class without combination of some sort. The necessity which forced the profit grinders to collect their men first into workshops working by the division of labour, and next into great factories worked by machinery, and so gradually draw them into the great towns and centres of civilization, gave birth to a distinct working class or proletariat. And this it was which gave them their mechanical existence. But note that they are indeed combined into social groups for the production of wares, but only as yet mechanical. They do not know what they are working at, nor whom they are working for, because they are combining to produce wares of which the profit of a master forms an essential part, instead of goods for their own use. As long as they do this and compete with each other for leave to do it, they will be, and will feel themselves to be, simply a part of those competing firms I have been speaking of. They will be, in fact, just a part of the machinery for production of profits. So long as this lasts, it will be the aim of the masters or profit makers to decrease the market value of this human part of the machinery. That is to say, since they already hold in their hands the labor of dead men in the form of capital machinery, it is their interest, or we will say their necessity, to pay as little as they can help for the labor of living men, which they have to buy from day to day. And since the workmen they employ have nothing but their labor power, they are compelled to underbid one another for employment and wages, and so enable the capitalists to pay his gains. I have said that as things go, the workers are part of the competing firms, an adjunct of capital. Nevertheless, they are only so by compulsion. And even without their being conscious of it, they struggle against that compulsion with its immediate results, the lowering of their wages, of their standard of life. And this they do, and must do, both as a class and individual. Just as the slave of the great Roman lord, though he distinctly felt himself to be part of the household, yet collectively was a force in reserve for its destruction, and individually stole from his lord whenever he could safely do so. So here, you see, is another form of war necessary to the way we live now, the war of class against class, and when it rises to its height, as it seems to be rising at present, will destroy those other forms of war we have been speaking of, will make the position of the profit makers of perpetual commercial war untenable, will destroy the present system of competitive privilege or commercial war. Now observe, I said that to the existence of the workers it was combination, not competition, that was necessary, while to that of the profit makers combination was impossible and war necessary. The present position of the workers is that of the machinery of commerce, or in plainer words, its slaves. When they change that position and become free, the class of profit makers must cease to exist, and what will then be the position of the workers? Even as it is, they are the one necessary part of society, the life-giving part. The other classes are but hangers-on who live on. But what should they be? What will they be when they, once for all, come to know their real power and cease competing with one another for livelihood? I will tell you. They will be society. They will be the community. And being society, that is, there being no class outside them to contend with, they can then regulate their labour in accordance with their own real needs. When the workers are society, they will regulate their labour so that the supply and demand shall be genuine, not gambling. The two will then be commensurate, for it is the same society which demands that also supplies. There will be no more artificial famines then, no more poverty amidst overproduction, amidst too great a stock of the very things which should supply poverty and turn it into well-being. In short, there will be no waste and therefore no tillage. Well, now, what socialism offers you in place of these artificial famines with their so-called overproduction is once more regulation of the markets. Supply and demand commensurate. No gambling and consequently, once more, no waste. No overwork and weariness for the worker one month, and the next no work and terror of starvation. But steady work and plenty of leisure every month. Not cheap market wares, that is to say adulterated wares, with scarcely any good in them, mere scaffold poles for building up profits. No labour would be spent on such things as these, which people would cease to want when they cease to be slaves. Not these, but such goods as best fulfilled the real uses of the consumers would labour be set to make. For profit being abolished, people could have what they wanted, instead of what the profit grinders at home and abroad forced them to take. Observe in the early years, the days of the history of man, he was the slave of his most immediate necessities. Nature was mighty and he was feeble, and he had to wage constant war with her for his daily food and such shelter as he could get. His life was bound down and limited by this constant struggle. All his morals, laws, religion are in fact the outcome of the reflection of this ceaseless toil of earning his livelihood. Time passed, and little by little, step by step, he grew stronger. Until now, after all these ages, he has almost completely conquered nature, and one would think should now have leisure to turn his thoughts towards higher things than procuring tomorrow's dinner. But alas, his progress has been broken and halted, and though he has indeed conquered nature and has her forces under his control to do what he will, he still has himself to think, to conquer. He still has to think how he will best use these forces which he has mastered. At present, he uses them blindly, foolishly, as one driven by mere fate. It would almost seem as if some phantom of the ceaseless pursuit of food, which was once the master of the savage, was still haunting the civilized man, who toils in a dream, as it were, haunted by mere dim, unreal hopes born out of vague recollections of the days gone by. Out of that dream he must wake and face things as they really are. The conquest of nature is complete, and now our business is, and has for long been, the organization of man, who wields the forces of nature. Nor till this is attempted, at least, shall we ever be free of that terrible phantom of fear of starvation, which, with its brother devil, desire of domination, drive us into injustice, cruelty, and dastardliness of all kinds. To cease to fear our fellows and learn to depend on them, to do away with competition and build up cooperation, is our one necessity. Now, to get closer to details, you probably know that every man in civilization is worth, so to say, more than his skin. Working as he must work socially, he can produce more than will keep himself alive and in fair condition. And this has been so for many centuries, from the time, in fact, when warring tribes began to make their conquered enemies slaves instead of killing them. And of course, this capacity of producing these extras has gone on increasing faster and faster, till today one man will weave, for instance, as much cloth in a week as will clothe a whole village for years. And the real question of civilization has always been, what are we to do with this extra produce of labor? A question which the phantom, fear of starvation, and its fellow, desire of domination, has driven men to answer pretty badly always, and worst of all, perhaps, in these present days, when the extra produce has grown with such prodigious speed. The practical answer has always been for man to struggle with his fellow for private possession of undue shares of these extras. And all kinds of devices have been employed by those who found themselves in possession of the power of taking them from others to keep those whom they have robbed in perpetual subjection. And these latter, as I have already hinted, had no chance of resisting this fleecing as long as they were few and scattered, and consequently could have little sense of their common oppression. But now that, owing to the very pursuit of these undue shares of profit or extra earnings, men have become more dependent on each other for production, and have been driven, as I said before, to combine together for that end more completely, the power of the workers, that is to say of the robbed or fleeced class, has enormously increased. And it only remains for them to understand that they have this power,
When they do that, they will be able to give the right answer to the question, what is to be done with the extra products of labour over and above what will keep the labourer alive to labour? Which answer is that the worker will have all that he produces and not be fleeced at all. And remember that he produces collectively, and therefore he will do effectively what work is required of him according to his capacity, and of the produce of that work he will have what he needs. What is it that I need, therefore, which my surrounding circumstances can give me, my dealings with my fellow men, setting aside inevitable accidents which cooperation and forethought cannot control? Well, first of all, I claim good health, and I say that a vast proportion of people in civilization scarcely even know what that means. To feel near life a pleasure, to enjoy the moving one's limbs and exercising one's bodily powers, to play, as it were, with sun and wind and rain, to rejoice in satisfying the due bodily appetites of a human animal without fear of degradation or sense of wrongdoing. Yes, and therewithal, to be well-formed, straight-limbed, strongly knit, expresses a countenance, to be, in a word, beautiful. That also. If we cannot have this claim satisfied, we are but poor creatures after all. And I believe that this claim for a healthy body for all of us carries with it the other due claims. For who knows where the seeds of disease which even rich people suffer from were first sown? From the luxury of an ancestor, perhaps, yet often, I suspect, from his poverty. And for the poor. A distinguished physicist has said that the poor suffer always from one disease, hunger. And at least I know this, that if a man is overworked in any degree, he cannot enjoy the sort of health I am speaking of. Nor can he if he is continually chained to one dull round of mechanical work, with no hope at the other end of it. Nor if he lives in continual sordid anxiety for his livelihood, nor if he is ill-housed, nor if he is deprived of all enjoyment of the natural beauty of the world, nor if he has no amusement to quicken the flow of his spirits from time to time. All these things, which touch more or less directly on his bodily condition, are born of the claim I make to live in good health. Indeed, I suspect that these good conditions must have been enforced for several generations before a population in general will be really healthy, as I've hinted above. But also, I doubt not that in the course of time they would, joined to other conditions, of which more hereafter, gradually breed such a population, living enjoyment of animal life at least. On this point, I may note that the very variations in the races of men are caused by the conditions under which they live. And though in these rougher parts of the world we lack some of the advantages of climate and surroundings, yet if we were working for livelihood and not for profit, we might neutralize the many disadvantages of our climate. Now, the next thing I claim is education. And you must not say that every English child is educated now. That sort of education will not answer my claim, though I cheerfully admit it is something. Something, and yet, after all, only class education. What I claim is liberal education. Opportunity, that is, to have my share of whatever knowledge there is in the world, according to my capacity or bent of mind, historical or scientific. And also to have my share of skill of hand, which is about in the world, either in the industrial handicrafts or the fine arts. I claim to be taught, if I can be taught, more than one craft to exercise for the benefit of the community. You may think this is a large claim, but I am clear that it is not too large a claim if the community is to have any gain out of my special capacities, if we are not all to be beaten down to a dull level of mediocrity, as we are now. But also, I know that this claim for education involves one for public advantages in the shape of public libraries, schools, and the like, such as no private person, not even the richest, could command. But these I claim very confidently, being sure that no reasonable community could bear to be without such helps to a decent life. Again, the claim for education involves a claim for abundant leisure, which once more I make with confidence, because once we have shaken off the slavery of profit, labour would be organised so unwastefully that no heavy burden would be laid on the individual citizens, every one of whom, as a matter of course, would have to pay his toll of some obviously useful work. At present, you must know that all the amazing machinery which we have invented has served only to increase the amount of profit-bearing wares. In other words, to increase the amount of profit pouched by individuals for their own advantage, part of which profit they use as capital for the production of more profit, with ever the same waste attached to it, and part as private riches or means for luxurious living, which again is sheer waste. In fact, to be looked on as a kind of bonfire on which rich men burn up the product of the labour they have fleeced from the worker beyond what they themselves can use. So that I say that in spite of our inventions, no worker works under the present system an hour less on account of those labour-saving machines so-called. But under a happier state of things, they would be used simply for saving labour, with the result of a vast amount of leisure gained for the community to be added to that gained by the avoidance of the waste of useless luxury and the abolition of the service of commercial war. Now again, this leisure would enable me to please myself and expand my mind by travel, if I had a mind. Because say, for instance, that I were a shoemaker. If due social order were established, it by no means follows that I should always be obliged to make shoes in one place. A due amount of easily conceivable arrangement would enable me to make shoes in Rome, say, for 3 months, and to come back with new ideas of building, gathered from the sight of the works of past ages, amongst other things, which would perhaps be of service in London. To take two strong instances of the contrary, I won't submit to be dressed up in red and marched off to shoot at my French or German or Arab friend in a quarrel that I don't understand. I will rebel sooner than do that. Nor will I submit to my time and energies in making some trifling toy which I know only a fool can desire. I will rebel sooner than do that. However, you may be sure that in a state of social order I shall have no need to rebel against any such pieces of unreason. Only I'm forced to speak from the way we live now to the way we might live. Again, if the necessary reasonable work be of a mechanical kind, I must be helped to it by a machine, not to cheapen my labour, but so that as little time as possible may be spent upon it, and that I may be able to think of other things while I'm tending the machine. And if the work be specially rough or exhausting, you will, I'm sure, agree with me in saying that I must take turns in doing it with other people. I mean, I mustn't, for instance, be expected to spend my working hours always at the bottom of a coal pit. I think such work as that ought to be largely voluntary and done, as I say, in spells. And what I say of very rough work, I say also of nasty work. On the other hand, I should think very little of the manhood of a stout and healthy man who did not feel a pleasure in doing rough work, always supposing him to work under the conditions I've been speaking of. Namely, feeling that it was useful, and consequently honoured, and that it was not continuous or hopeless, and that he was really doing it of his own free will. The last claim I make for my work is that the places I worked in, factories or workshops, should be pleasant, just as the fields where our most necessary work is done are pleasant. Believe me, there is nothing in the world to prevent this being done, save the necessity of making profits on all wares. In other words, the wares are cheapened at the expense of people being forced to work in crowded, unwholesome, squalid, noisy dens. That is to say, they are cheapened at the expense of the workman's life. Well, so much for my claims as to my necessary work, my tribute to the community. I believe people would find, as they advanced in their capacity for carrying on social order, that life so lived was much less expensive than we now can have any idea of, and that after a little, people would rather be anxious to seek work than avoid it, that our working hours would rather be merry parties of men and maids, young men and old enjoying themselves over their work, than the grumpy weariness it mostly is now. Then would come the time for the new birth of it, so much talked of, so long deferred. People could not help showing their mirth and pleasure in their work, and would be always wishing to express it in a tangible and more or less enduring form. And the workshop would once more be a school of art, whose influence no one could escape from. I feel sure that the time will come when people will find it difficult to believe that a rich community such as ours, having such command over external nature, could have submitted to live such a mean, shabby, dirty life as we did. There is nothing in our circumstances save the hunting of profit that drives us into this. It is profit that drives men to unmanageable aggregations called towns. Profit which crowds them up when they are there into quarters without gardens or open spaces. Profit which won't take the most ordinary precautions against wrapping a whole district in a cloud of sulphurous smoke. Which turns beautiful rivers into filthy sewers. Which condemns all but the rich to live in houses idiotically cramped and confined at the best, and at the worst in houses for those whose wretchedness there is no more. I say it is almost incredible that we should bear such crass stupidity as this, nor should we if we could help it. We shall not bear it when the workers get out of their heads that they are but an appendage to profit. That the more profits that are made, the more employment at high wages there will be for them, and that therefore all the incredible filth, disorder, and degradation of modern civilization are signs of their prosperity. So far from that, they are signs of their slavery. When they are no longer slaves, they will claim as a matter of course that every man and every family should be generously lodged, that every child should be able to play in a garden close to the place where his parents live in, that the houses should, by their obvious decency and order, be ornaments to nature, not disfigurements. For the decency and order above mentioned, when carried to the due pitch, would most assuredly lead to beauty in building. All this, of course, would mean the people, that is, all society, duly organized, having in its own hands the means of production, to be owned by no individual, but used by all as occasion called for its use, and can only be done on those terms. On any other terms, people would be driven to accumulate private wealth for themselves, and thus, as we have seen, to waste the goods of the community and perpetuate the division into classes, which means continual war and waste. As to what extent it may be necessary or desirable for people under social orders to live in common, we may differ pretty much according to our tendencies towards social life. For my part, I can't see why we should think it hardship to eat with the people we work with. I'm sure that as to many things, such as valuable books, pictures, and splendor of surroundings, we shall find it better to club our means together. And I must say that often when I have been sickened by the stupidity of the mean, idiotic rabbit warrens, which rich men build for themselves in Bayswater and elsewhere, I console myself with visions of the noble communal hall of the future. Unsparing of materials, generous in worthy ornament, alive with the noblest thoughts of our time and the past, embodied in the best art which a free and manly people could produce. Such an abode of man has no private enterprise could come anywhere near for beauty and fitness, because only collective thought and collective life could cherish the aspirations which would give birth to its beauty, or have the skill and leisure to carry them out. I, for my part, should think it much the reverse of a hardship if I had to read my books and meet my friends in such a place. Nor do I think I am better off to live in a vulgar, stuccoed house, overcrowded with upholstery that I despise, in all respects degrading to the mind and elevating to the body to live in, simply because I call it my own or my house. Before I leave this matter of the surroundings of life, I wish to meet a possible objection. I've spoken of machinery being used freely for releasing people from the more mechanical and repulsive part of necessary labour. And I know that to some cultivated people, people of the artistic turn of mind, machinery is particularly distasteful. And they will be apt to say, you will never get your surroundings pleasant as long as you are surrounded by machinery. I don't quite admit that. It is allowing the machines to be our masters and not our servants that so injures the beauty of life nowadays. In other words, it is the token of the terrible crime we have fallen into of using our control of the powers of nature for the purpose of enslaving them. We care less, meantime, of how much happiness we rob their lives. Yet, for the consolation of the artists, I will say that I believe indeed that a state of social order would probably lead at first to a great development of machinery for really useful purposes. Because people will still be anxious about getting through the work necessary to holding society together. but that after a while they will find that there is not so much work to do as they expect, and that then they will have leisure to reconsider the whole subject. And if it seems to them that a certain industry would be carried on more pleasantly as regards the worker, and more effectually as regards the goods, by using handwork rather than machinery, they will certainly get rid of their machinery, because it will be possible for them to do so. It isn't possible now. We are not at liberty to do so. We are slaves to the monsters we have created. And I have a kind of hope that the very elaboration of machinery in a society whose purpose is not the multiplication of labour, as it now is, but the carrying on of a pleasant life, as it would be under social order, that the elaboration of machinery, I say, will lead to the simplification of life, and so once more the limitation of machinery. It is not we who can build up the new social order. The past ages have done the most of that work for us. But we can clear our eyes to the signs of the times, and we shall see then that the attainment of a good condition of life is being made possible for us, and that it is now our business to stretch our hands to take it. And how? Chiefly, I think, by educating people to a sense of their real capacities as men, so that they will be able to use to their own good the political power which is rapidly being thrust upon them, to get them to see that the old system of organizing labor for individual profit is becoming unmanageable, and that the whole people have now got to choose between the confusion resulting from the breakup of that system and the determination to take in hand the labor now organized for profit and use its organization for the livelihood of the community. To get people to see that individual profit makers are not a necessity for labour, but an obstruction to it. And that not only or chiefly because they are the perpetual pensioners of labour, as they are, but rather because of the waste which their existence as a class necessitates. All this we have to teach people when we have taught ourselves. And I admit that the work is long and burdensome, as I began by saying. People have been made so timorous of change by the terror of starvation that even the unluckiest of them are stolid and hard to move. Hard as the work is, however, its reward is not doubtful. The mere fact that a body of men, however small, are banded together as socialist missionaries shows that the change is going on, as the working class, the real organic part of society, take in these ideas, hope will arise in them, and they will claim changes in society, many of which doubtless will not tend directly towards their emancipation, because they will be claimed without due knowledge of the one thing necessary to claim, equality of condition, but which indirectly will help to break up our rotten sham society, while that claim for equality of condition will be made constantly, and with growing loudness, till it must be listened to. And then at last it will only be a step over the border, and the civilized world will be socialized. And looking back on what has been, we shall be astonished to think of how long we submitted to live as we live now.